Thursday, January 23rd, we welcomed back to Connecticut Today one of our regulars, Chris Powell from the Manchester Journal-Enquirer. Chris writing excellent editorials regarding two hot-button issues in Connecticut. One, the relationship between cities and suburbs when it comes to affordable housing, and also the questions that remain about how UConn brings in and spends money. In the 5 o'clock hour, we had an ongoing analysis of the current impeachment proceedings going on in the Senate from Dr. Wesley Renfro. He's the Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences and a political science professor at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. I'm okay today. A little tired. I went to bed a little bit later overnight than I had projected. I'm all set to go to bed last night. I did some laundry, answered some emails, you know, just got my whole kind of self in order. And I'm literally set to crawl in bed. I said, okay, let me go do this in the kitchen. Took that pill before I went to bed. And I said, okay, let me go lock the door. So I, you know, open the door, make sure everything was clear out front. So I go to lock the door. I have two locks on my condo door. Again, I live in a high rise, so I'm not exposed to the outside. But still, you know, it's a very safe building. Nothing's ever happened to me in there. And, you know, I get ready to throw the deadbolt and also to turn the knob bolt to the lock position. Two locks is fine. Again, we have an outside door, too. The building itself is very safe. So I turn the knob before I, you know, the doorknob before I will go to shut the door just to make sure everything's free and easy, and it jams. And I said, oh, great. Fabulous. It's like 10 after midnight, and my door is jammed. This is great. Absolutely wonderful. You can't make this up. So, well, guess who's not going to bed early? Yee-haw. So about 45 minutes later, maybe an hour, I was able to unjam the lock number one, but I could tell that it was shot. It's been there for probably 10, 20 years. It was there when I moved in. This coming September will be 20 years I've lived there. So I was there, and I said, oh, all right, I got to take it off and tape over the hole, you know, with some gaffer's tape so nobody can look in. The deadbolt still locked the door, so I've got right in my hand here, I've got my Home Depot gift card. So guess where your friendly afternoon host will be heading after the show is done today? After I go out and grab something to eat, we'll be going and picking up a new lock set. Thank you. Well, you know, but it's just those little things. And it's a good thing that I didn't shut the door and then turn the knob, because it would have jammed with the lock engaged, which would have meant a call to, you guessed it, a locksmith. So I was very careful when I was working on everything, you know, keep a shoe in the door. Don't let the door swing shut before you get your trusty screwdriver and pliers and you remove the door lock. So there you go. What was your night last night? That was my night. But, you know, I took it off. I swabbed down all the innards of the door, cleaned it out nice. The deadbolt still works just fine, but I'm going to go out and get a matched set. You know what I used to have where I used to live is kind of cool, but I just don't want to spend the money because I'm lazy. I've had one of those digital locks before, which is kind of cool. You know, you literally, they're cool because you don't have to worry about getting locked out. You know, you put a 4 or 5-digit code in and you just, I looked online last night and like there was a very nice one, all kinds of good ratings on Amazon and on Home Depot site. And it was like $65. I'm like, I'll just carry my keys, whatever. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Of the two locks on my door, because our building is so safe, again, it has a foyer lock where you have to either get buzzed in by somebody or an outside door. I rarely, if ever, use the knob lock, so that there's really no chance of that locking in back of me if I'm out. I do use the deadbolt all the time, so that's the last thing I want to do is get locked out. What an awful thing. Have you ever got locked out of your house? That's never happened to me. And I've never got locked out of my car either with the key in the ignition. Now, my car, it's funny, this one I have now, my present car, and two cars ago, It has a nice little bounce back feature on there where if the key is in the ignition, you can't lock the door. You cannot lock the door. And every so often I'll go to lock the door and it'll bounce back and it'll beep and say, oh, yeah, you idiot. You left the key in the ignition. So that's good. I have that on the car I have now, which is not new. In fact, the car I have now is going on 9 years, knock on wood, as I hit my head. And I had that on the car I had before that. The car I had previous to this did not have that, which is kind of weird. So that was my night last night. How was yours? Did your lock jam too 5 minutes before you wanted to crawl in bed? Did you have to get these two different screwdrivers, a plier, and your friendly can of WD-40, which when you're not on lubing locks, you can fry an egg with, which is kind of cool. The petroleum base kind of gets into that scrambled egg motif. In fact, I don't know whether you know this. People say, why is it called WD-40? Apparently, from what I read, that was the 40th, mixture of the various lubricants that some industrial guy or guys came up with. You know, they were trying to create the all-purpose lubricant, which, that well, not all, there's other, no, you can't use it for that. But WD, that was the 40th formulation, apparently, that worked. So where would the world be? What would guys and gals do without WD-40 on one end of the spectrum and duct tape, gaffer's tape, on the other end of the spectrum? Oh, look at this. We have a WD-40 fan on the phone. Steve in Bridgeport. Steve, what's up?
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Good, what's up?
Good point about all the people that voted against Trump. Usually
yeah.
I call in for political stuff, but I thought I'd throw something out. WD-40
yeah.
also repels water. So if you have any metal parts, if you have a classic car, lawnmower,
yeah.
anything over the winter you want to store, whatever, and you want to keep that rust off it, a little mist of WD-40, and you'll never get rust on it. Again, battery cables, you know,
nice.
They get all quackalot there.
Yeah.
You give it a little spray of that. And anything metal that could rust, a little mist of WD-40, and you're good to go. Patio stuff outside, whatever you got.
It's great to, I use that little, you know, the little stick so you can get into a lock,
yes.
like the driver's side door on my car. When you get that cold, damp weather, the lock sticks like crazy, but a couple of squirts of WD-40, man, it's like butter. Let me tell you something.
And now that you have it in there, it'll repel the water,
nice.
And you probably won't have that rest of the problem
nice.
All winter. So
yeah.
you got off on a light side today. I was out,
nice.
And I'm just going to go stay
so
with
Steve,
the light WD-40.
So, Steve, yes. let me ask you before you go, do you use it on toast at all? Do you put it on toast?
No.
No? No?
Hey, but remember when... No, I don't put it on...
No, a little squirt. Crap! I'm out of butter. Let me put some WD.
But remember back in the day when we were kids and
yeah.
everything was made of metal and everything rusted. You
oh,
know what
yeah.
I mean? The WD-40, our little metal fire engines and
yes.
the Triton. I mean, everything we had. We could have slit our throat with just the little bicycles we had.
And then we fixed it with duct tape. WD-40 and duct tape. That's all you
the
need.
The best thing
yeah.
I ever saw, I told you, I'm in the building trade.
Yeah.
So we're doing a job in Fairfield years
okay.
ago, and this kid
yeah.
wearing a helmet, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So he's riding up and down the street. So now he comes in front of his house, and he's
yeah.
going to go in the house. He takes the helmet off.
Yeah.
He walks right into a piece of wood, knocks him right on his back.
Why? Was he high? What the hell was wrong with him?
No. He's just a kid. So he got off his bike. He had his helmet
oh.
on. He was doing what his mom wanted. So now he was walking up the front steps. So I guess something was in the way. He was talking to his buddy. Hit the wood. And he went right back on his backside.
I ran into a church railing once. I never saw the thing because it was blending into the side of the church. And
oh.
I swear, I look like, you know, I was right out of a Three Stooges scene. Boom. Right into the church railing. Don't ask me how.
Oh. I'll tell you, the first car seat my sister had in six, she was born in 65.
Yeah.
It was nothing more than a banana, a plastic thing that looked like a slot
yeah.
with a wheel with a red knob. And in those days, my mother put her in the front of the 65
nice.
Impala. The cops didn't have to come and
no.
We used to go back and forth from Long Island to Connecticut. So we had family up
oh.
here or whatever. And, three people, six of us in the Impala, you know, three in the back and three in the
nobody
front.
Nobody belted it. Nobody with a seatbelt on, right?
No, nobody with a seatbelt on. And no cop had to come. I mean, that first
no.
car seat, I'll tell you a very quick story.
Yeah.
My mother was coming from church one day. We grew up. I grew up in Long Island, a little town called Williston Park.
Okay.
So my sister was in the back.
Yeah.
And in those days, you could open up the back door. Remember, before you had the pin, you could just put something.
The child lock. Yeah, the child lock.
Right, 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 right. So the door swung open, and my sister was in the back seat. This is on Willis Avenue. If any Long Island people are listening.
All right.
And so my sister, the door opens up, and my mother looks over the seat because it was a bench seat, and she sees the pavement. So my mother cocks the wheel the other way.
Oh, Jesus.
Shuts the door.
Oh, it's
my sister, whatever. My mother was quick enough to say because she was young. So in other words, as she was crossing Willis Avenue,
my
sister had the door opened because no child. And my sister's going, Ma, Ma, she's holding on to the armrest. And my mother could see the asphalt. So then my mother thought real quick. She turned the wheel.
That's great.
Shut the door, and, she was coming out of, I know we get a lot of Long Island people listen to us. She was coming out of St. Aidan's Catholic Church on Willis Avenue and Williston Park. Williston Park, Long Island. Oh,
that's great.
My mother told that story.
Steve, that's great. I appreciate the call, Steve. Thanks so much. That's great stuff. Steve there in Bridgeport. Oh, my God. So the door's opening. His sister's about to fall out of the car. So mom cocks the wheel to the left, changes the momentum of the car. The door slams shut and keeps her in the car. Way to go, mom. Monthly check-in talking about his latest couple of columns. I know he was riveted to what's going on in the Senate today. He's scoring at home, keeping an eye on the wonderful Adam Schiff and the House Democrats. That, of course, being Chris Powell. Chris, how are you?
I'm fine, Paul, but actually I'm not paying an awful lot of attention to what's going on in Washington. I'm afraid I've made up my mind on that.
Wait a minute, Chris. You're not sitting there with a nice triple malt scotch and a bowl of popcorn soaking this all in? Come on.
Well, I'm not sure I could handle scotch popcorn, maybe.
Okay.
No, I'm afraid I've made up my mind on this stuff.
Yes,
I'm afraid that the indictment didn't make really any charges that are impeachable, in my opinion, and the trial is going off on things that aren't in the indictment.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, how is this possible? It's like they accused Trump of in the House of wearing socks that don't match, and they're trying him in the Senate for picking his nose.
Oh, man. Thank God there's that old thing, Chris. The House proposes and the Senate disposes. On to your columns. You have one today and one coming out on Sunday. You know, the one today I was cheering. And listen, you and I both know we all love UConn. We all love having a flagship university, a university that does do some really good research and cranks out these championship sports teams. And, since the Whalers left, UConn is kind of our major league team and all that. Well, not so much the football program. That's another time. But you have a piece here that floats a question that I have floated for years on shows like this, Chris, is where's the UConn oversight here and their constant shivering if there's any notion of cutting back on their state funding? It's maddening to me sometimes.
Well, there really is no oversight for UConn, Paul. It's the fourth branch of government in Connecticut, and no governor has ever put any serious questions to it, and very few legislators have. What bothered me a little the other day was when UConn issued a big report claiming that it had $5 billion worth of economic impact on the state every year. And the university seemed to be putting this out as an argument for the governor and the General Assembly to give the university more money or relieve it of its pension obligations, which really are cannibalizing the whole of state government. The argument of this economic impact report, seemed to be like that of all these economic impact reports that we've discovered perpetual motion. And if you just keep giving us money, we'll be generating more and more money, and it's perpetual prosperity. And I don't think that's correct about UConn. UConn does bring some money into the state. Out-of-state students pay more, and the university does get federal government and foundation grants. But other than that, I think it's really just recycling the money that taxpayers give it and that students give it in tuition. And in any case, being this, this great economic leviathan. That's not why we have a state university. We have a state university because we want to teach our own young people the higher skills they can gain and give them more knowledge so they can have more productive and happier lives. That's the purpose of the university. It's not to be a recycler of money. I mean, it's money's nature to be recycled. Whether you give it to UConn to spend, you leave it in the pockets of taxpayers, it's going to be spent anyway. Even if taxpayers think they're saving their money by putting it in the bank is going to lend it many times over. Banks will lend out, 9 or 10 times the money that is deposited mm-hmm. with them by depositors. So money is going to get recycled anyway. Recycling money is not the highest objective of a university. Teaching is, and we do not seem to have from UConn any kind of audit of just how much teaching its full professors are doing as compared to the teaching done by the adjunct junior professors and the graduate assistants. So I've asked for that kind of report from UConn in years past, and I've never gotten anything. As far as I can determine, the legislature and the governor have never asked for it either. But it's teaching that counts at UConn. It's not recycling money.
And Chris, and I know that in-state students do get a bit of a break. The out-of-state students pay more. I'm all right with that. But, I sat next to an aunt of mine who just turned 90, wonderful lady, still sharp as a tack. She went to UConn back in the 50s, early 60s, when you could go there as an in-state student. And now, obviously, times have changed. But it was affordable, Chris, for the average middle to lower middle-income person to go there. I think she said her classes were something like $800 a year or $900 a year. Now I see, even for the in-state students, Chris, the creep up in tuition. And when you bring that up to somebody, as I have and other people have, and maybe those in the General Assembly and maybe you have, the answer is, well, the other folks can go to the community colleges. That's what they're for. Chris, excuse me, I thought the object of a state university was to offer a high-quality education to all taxpayers in the state at an affordable cost.
Yeah, the tuition at UConn is now at $30,000 a year, which just astounds me. Talk about your aunt. Well, I went to UConn in the late 60s and early 70s. I was a semester short of graduation when I left. I was getting a little bored with it, and I had a job waiting for me. But I had some courses there that even today mean the world to me. And, Paul, I went there for about 5 years off and on. And I remember really paying only for books. Now, most of that time I was a commuting student, but I had virtually no expenses in going
wow.
to UConn
wow.
50 years ago. I could go to school full time. I could work part time during vacations and summers. I could afford my own apartment, and the state of Connecticut gave me this enormous gift, which is a virtually free higher education. Now, the facilities out there were really a shadow of the beautiful things we have out there today. I know we need beautiful facilities today to attract students, and they've done a beautiful job in many respects at UConn, but that is not the key to a good education. The courses I remember that have had such an impact on me even today were held in rather shabby old buildings. It was the teaching, it was the professors that I had who taught those courses and instilled in me the importance of what they were teaching. And I didn't pay a damn thing for it except for books. What a gift this was to me and to your aunt.
Amazing. All right, Chris, hang on. We'll be back to you. We'll talk about your upcoming column for Sunday. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC 600. It's Connecticut Today. And we spent a few more minutes here with one of our monthly guests, Chris Powell of the Manchester Journal-Inquirer, the JI of Manchester. First column we wanted to touch on came out today regarding UConn. Chris, we have one coming up Sunday regarding You know, the big bugaboo here, we have a big thing going on in Fairfield County, town to Fairfield, affordable housing. But I think you do a good job in this column of pointing out a little bit of the hypocrisy that goes on with some of our big city mayors here and the rather affluent suburbs who are run by the same party as some of these mayors.
Yeah, the mayor of Hartford, Luke Cronin, had a press conference the other day, Paul, in which he complained about suburban zoning, excluding the poor, complained that the federal and state governments concentrate most of their housing for the poor subsidies in Hartford. The 39% of Hartford's housing is formally designated as housing for the poor. And, you know, he said with, you know, complete fairness that the suburbs ought to be sharing more of this burden. But on the other hand, if you're in the suburbs, you have to wonder, if he doesn't want them, why should we? And I think the real issue here is not so much the unfairness of housing policy and the exclusionary zoning of the suburbs as the failure of government poverty policy to alleviate poverty. You know, so many people have moved out of Connecticut cities to the suburbs precisely to escape the impoverishment of their neighbors in the cities. One of the first things that conferences I went to as a young journalist 50 years ago was a conference on the concentration of poverty in the cities in Connecticut and what could be done about it. And, you know, here we are 50 years later, and the concentration of poverty in the cities is worse. And I think the suburbs fairly ask, or they think because they're afraid of asking, you know, why do we want more people in our town, more unmarried, unskilled, undereducated, single women with four or five kids by four or five different fathers, people who can't support themselves, whose kids are neglected, who are at greater risk for crime and educational failure and needing social services and all these expenses? Why do the suburbs want these expenses? It's, you know, not necessarily so evil of them to question this. Our real problem here is that we are not alleviating poverty. We're not eradicating poverty. The cities in Connecticut are poverty factories. We really engender poverty with our welfare policies that destroy the family. We let unmotivated students stay unmotivated with our policies in education of social promotion. And this failure to eradicate poverty, I think, is behind the suburban exclusionary zoning. And I don't think you can address the zoning problem without addressing the poverty problem.
And the other problem, Chris, in cities all over the state, like, you know, in Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven, you and I see when it's wonderful when these cities are doing better. New Haven's doing very well now. Bridgeport's still the most populous city in the state. New apartments, new condos coming in, even in Hartford. But again, Chris, the problem is the rents and the costs for somebody to live there in some of these centers of poverty. I mean, you know, some of these social justice folks always, and with good reason sometimes, talk about gentrification. But you never see that aimed at some of these big developers who woo these cities with major money. You know, they take these bombed out factories, which is great, but then when they're done, you know, a studio apartment costs $1,300 a month. I mean, it seems to me that we're not pointing the, and I'm all for free enterprise, but some of the issues here really aren't being addressed.
Well, it's hard to have enough housing. You know, people who want housing, they want housing prices to go up, but, you know, housing is a necessity of life, just like you know, food and gasoline and medical care. When housing prices go up, people are priced out, and we don't have enough housing now. You know, part of that is because the suburbs are so exclusive. You know, part of that is because we don't really encourage housing ownership. among the poor in Connecticut. We give them Section 8 vouchers, so you know they can spend them with landlords, and the landlords get rich off housing policy. I've been to Singapore a few times on some other business, and they have a remarkable policy there where essentially the government builds high-rise apartment condos, lovely places, and they allow ordinary Singaporeans to draw against basically their social insurance savings in the Central Provident Fund there, and they can use their social insurance savings to buy and own housing that the government has built. And the basic effect of this in Singapore is that there's very little poverty in Singapore. Most people are owning their own homes. Now, they do something in Singapore we can't do here. That is, they assign people to housing by their ethnic group. They don't want all the, you know, the Malays living in one building and the Europeans living in another and the Chinese living in another. They mix the ethnic groups up to, you know, prevent this ethnic grouping. But they have a remarkably egalitarian society there with a lot of home ownership and very little income inequality and great stability. And I think this arises from the greater degree of property ownership they have in Singapore. Here, of course, we don't have that degree of property ownership, and really most of the poor are renters, and they are not able to build up the family capital that people can build up in Singapore. If you're an American and your parents owned a house, well, odds are you're going to end up owning a house too, or it's going to be willed to you, and you and your family can build up some capital through housing. But if we're going to make the poor into renters in the United States, they're not going to build up capital.
Exactly. Chris, listen, it's going to get better, I know, because especially here in Connecticut, because I know very soon we'll be able to pay our tolls only on the bridges if we're driving trucks while smoking marijuana and betting NFL football on our phones while Marty Looney creates a new police department to battle right-wing extremism. So I think we'll be what the heck? Chris, in about the minute we have left, that Looney thing, that's got to be a shot across the bow for the elections coming up. That's like you're a bad man if you associate with Donald Trump. That's my guess there.
Yeah, you know, are they really saying that there's, you know, only right-wing hate groups in this country? If they've never heard of Antifa and, you know, the left-wing hate groups we have here? I mean, that's really so brazenly political, it's disgraceful.
Chris Powell, as always, thank you, Chris. We'll talk to you next month. Great stuff, as always. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. All right, folks, you can check out his, you can Google his columns. He was once the managing editor for the Manchester J.I., now staying on as a columnist, editorialist, Chris Powell. For another look at this, we welcome Dr. Wesley Renfro, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. Dr. Renfro, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
Great.
From what you have seen here, give me your overall picture on what you have seen here so far. I know we're about a day and a half into the arguments, 2.5 days in the trial. What do you see here?
Well, I think the proceedings thus far have been sort of heavy on constitutional history and on theories of law. And, you know, the facts of this case are actually not really in dispute. There's questions about the degree to which this qualifies as an impeachable offense and what folks ought to do. I think that, you know, the Democrats are trying to build this case that rests a lot on, you know, history and on constitutional interpretation. And I think they're doing an okay job of it, but I'm not sure that it's making for sort of scintillating watching. And I'm sort of getting the impression that, you know, a lot of people are not paying as much attention to the proceedings as they might have otherwise.
Yeah, you know, Doctor, I've said this numerous times, and you've obviously seen this in your teaching and in your background. I'm old enough to remember having sat through. I was young. I was 10, 11, 12. But I sat through the Nixon thing, and even back then, I could kind of understand what this was about. You know, people understood the whole Bill Clinton thing. It wasn't really about sex. It was lying to a federal judge. That's perjury. I think you're right here, Doctor. I think both sides kind of have to admit that this is kind of very foggy bottom-ish, you know, with the State Department and who said what and who's really right here. You're right. It's hard to find the meat here, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that people entered these proceedings largely with their minds made up, perhaps save for a small number of folks. And so, you know, there's a lot of back and forth about sort of how to interpret these things, but they're sort of in the weeds a little bit. And I just don't really know, to be honest, that this is actually so much about impeachment as it may be about the election, for example. And that's not a dig at Democrats. I think that's going on both sides. This is sort of... you know, barring something really revelatory, which I don't expect to see, the conclusion of this is preordained. That doesn't mean that I'm saying that that it shouldn't have happened, but I see you know, a lot of grandstanding outside the chamber. I see you know, not really anything that will change many minds, at least that's been presented thus far.
Yeah, and also, the doctor, I thought it was an interesting point that Jonathan Turley brought up in the House part of this, who said, listen, I'm not exonerating President Trump. I'm not supporting him or maybe what he did, but I thought it was interesting when he brought up the part about the House part of it, the evidence gathering, discovery, really being kind of rushed here. And if they really wanted not to wrestle about Ambassador Bolton or some of these documents, they should have started earlier and used the courts to compel the testimony.
Well, you know, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the Democrats because, you know, the court proceedings could take, you know, months and months and months, and there's no guarantee that it would be resolved in time to conduct a normal election in 2020. I do think perhaps it was somewhat rushed, but the calendar is what the calendar is, and we're in somewhat of uncharted territory given that this is the first impeachment that we've had in an election year. And so I don't really know that there's a good way to square all those things.
Dr. Renfro, hang on. We'll be right back with you for a couple more minutes. Dr. Wesley B. Renfro is the guest from Quinnipiac University in Hamden. He's an associate professor of political science and associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Back with more from Dr. Renfro. First, traffic and weather together for you every 10 minutes on the sixes. 5:36 at WICC. And a couple more minutes with our guest of the hour. Happy to have Dr. Wesley Renfro with us. He is an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. Go Bobcats this weekend at the Webster Bank Arena. Dr. Renfro, from a political point of view, this is really fascinating, at least for this week, in all of next week probably. This keeps Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren off of the Democratic campaign trail, because we're, what, 2 weeks out from the Iowa caucuses, and this essentially leaves, you know, like kids in a candy store, right? This is a free run for Joe Biden and for Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah, and I actually wouldn't discount Amy Klobuchar from that either. You know, Iowa is actually really difficult to predict for a number of reasons, because the second the way the caucuses work mean that second-choice candidates can end up first-choice candidates pretty easily as the night wears on. And so I certainly think that Pete Buttigieg thinks that there's an opportunity for him to do pretty well. And this is really a make-or-break contest for him. I think Joe Biden sort of counting on his inertia to carry him through. But certainly for the senators who are also running in 2020, this is a bad outcome for them. They would rather be out there stumping.
They must be. I don't know whether you saw today, professor or doctor, but the CNN is reporting that some of the Senate members are actually using fidget spinners.
Yeah.
What does that say about American politics?
Well, I also saw some really great coverage of Rand Paul doing a rather elaborate doodle. But to be fair, there's really not that much for them to do. Electronic devices are banned. And, you know, the actual facts are not really in dispute. And there hasn't been much introduced, really anything that is new or novel.
Yeah, no, and I get that. And all this really, doctor, I mean, you know, you look at the president's base, it's still around 42, 43, 44%. The amount of people that don't like him, that have no intention of voting for him, mid to upper 40s. So again, isn't this really going to come down to that persuadable 6, 7, 8, 10%, especially in these swing states, Dr. Renfro, where we see that, you know, you strip away the gross numbers here, the totals in these polls, and it's really tight in about 5 or 6 swing states.
Yeah, and you know, it's complicated because we think about, you know, surveys, especially here at Quinnipiac, but, you know, the mood of the country doesn't translate into the will of the senators, and this is fundamentally up to them. And it's really, I think, far-fetched, barring something truly outrageous. You know, we're just not going to end up with the president being removed. But even when we think about, you know, the public opinion polls, you know, there is, you know, a lot of folks who sort of think that the president should be impeached. But when you ask about whether or not the president should be removed, support falls pretty dramatically, which to me suggests that there's a lot of people who think that there's something not quite right here, but they probably also think that it doesn't rise to the level of getting rid of a president. And I will say that I think that some of that is actually about the fact that it's an election year. You know, we are not that far away from giving the people their say in terms of whether or not they want to keep Donald Trump as president. And I can't help but think that that's influencing some of the folks who think, well, something here is not right, but I don't quite know that I want him out, even if I don't support him.
And, you know, Donald Trump, as we both know, Dr. Renfro, this is a guy who makes no bones about the fact of who he is, with the tweeting, with the offhand jokes, with the, you know, throwing of paper towels out, rolls of paper towels. But yet, I think he illustrates, and I say this all the time, Dr. Renfro, he's not the problem. He is the result of this bifurcation that we are having, I think, which is increasing in the U.S., the separation of the coastal areas, New York, L.A., D.C., Chicago, and the rest of the country. I wonder where this is going to lead us in the next 10 years.
Well, so, you know, I think that one of the, I think that we tend to focus on sort of controversy or story du jour, but there are these slow-moving but very important stories that we don't think about very often. And I think perhaps that one of the most important of them is the demographic self-sorting of the country. And it's not just where we live. You know, 50 years ago, people were much more likely to live on streets that were mixed in different ways ideologically. They were much more likely to marry across the aisle, for example. And so we are increasingly, and this predates Facebook, you know, Facebook and social media has exacerbated this trend, but these things were happening long before we had social media. We are, in fact, choosing in all sorts of ways, by marriage, by profession, by residence, to only interact or increasingly interact with people who view the world in the same terms that we do. And I don't think that's good.
No, it's not. And I have never not spoken to somebody on a show like this or unfriended anyone because of their politics. I think, Dr. Renfro, a thing that we are losing sight of here is so much of our politics is sewn into us by how we were raised.
Sure.
And no, you're not, no Facebook post, you know, unless you want to tweak a friend of yours, no Facebook post is going to change 20, 30, or 40 years of how a person was raised and their ingrained experiences.
Yeah, you know, we talk about political socialization, and there's lots of really great evidence that suggests that, you know, people still get most of their ideology from the environments where they spend time, and that's parents, and that's churches and temples and mosques and schools. But there is sort of this culture of shouting that has grown up, and I'm actually not convinced that all that shouting really changes people's minds. It just makes them mad.
No, it's confirmation bias. Finally, Dr. Renfro, if you had to guess, and I'm not putting you on the spot here, no money will be exchanged here, but does Joe Biden survive all the way? Does he get the nomination despite his age, despite the gaffes? Do you think that the electorate on the Democratic side said, listen, it's going to be tough. This is the guy who may be able to pull it off in November?
Well, you know, I don't want to say that he's the odds-on favorite, but he's certainly the front runner. You know, he's got a great big firewall in Super Tuesday, and I think that unless some other candidates can really grow their support among minority communities, in particular among African Americans, it's going to be tough to beat Joe Biden. But of course, you know, there's still a lot of things that can happen, and it's a crowded race. And when you have crowded races, three-person, four-person races, they're harder to extrapolate from because there's more moving pieces. So I certainly wouldn't swear by any of this. But if I were Joe Biden, I'd feel pretty good right now.
And a final question. What do you think, Dr. Renfro, behind closed doors, when the door is shut and the ties come off and people put their feet up, what's the hierarchy of the DNC saying about Bernie Sanders right now?
Well, I don't think they like him very much. And, you know, in 2016, there were these, I think, well-documented instances of the DNC perhaps not treating Senator Sanders very well, and Senator Sanders' supporters were sort of aghast at all this. And I sort of said, well, you know, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat. He has refused for the entirety of his career to join the Democratic Party. And so maybe the Democrats should be nicer to him, but it makes total sense to me that folks in the DNC are not especially thrilled, you know, with him trying to take over their party. And I do think that if Senator Sanders really gets some traction, that you will see rank-and-file Democrats coalescing around whoever is left standing to oppose him.
Which is interesting, because the way they changed the superdelegate rules, the superdelegates, if I remember, Doctor, this time around, they cannot kick in until a second ballot. Is that correct?
I believe that is true, although I would say that if we got all the way to the point of superdelegates, I don't think... You know, I think it would be such a public relations disaster. I can't imagine any scenario in which the superdelegates denied Senator Sanders the nomination if he had gotten the votes gotten close.
But admit it, for your classes there, wouldn't a brokered convention be just a great teaching tool?
Well, in 2016, I was certain that the Republicans were headed there. Their rules make brokered conventions easier.
Yeah.
And when Ted Cruz dropped out, I was a little bit disappointed, because I would have liked to have seen one.
We all want one. Great stuff, Dr. Wesley Renfro, Ph.D. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Associate Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Quinnipiac University. Dr. Renfro, thanks. Have a great weekend. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bubba.